Hello, I'm Rachel Cochran, and I'm bringing you this podcast from the Quilliam Brothers Tea House on the corner of Claremont Road and Barras Bridge, close to the University of Newcastle. Not only does it have some scrumptious grub, but there's also 60 types of tea to choose from. And it's in this wonderful, vibrant atmosphere that Victoria Watson's writing group meet every Monday night, 7 till 9pm. And here's a selection of their work to listen to, inspired by their meeting here at the Quilliam Brothers Tea House.
I Kissed a Girl in Temple Bar, written and read by Harry Gallagher. I kissed a girl in Temple Bar and dreamed into her eyes. I kissed a girl in Temple Bar, she laughed in sweet surprise. I kissed that girl, she kissed me back, and all behind her husband's back. Yes, I kissed a girl with flaming hair, she'd have let me kiss her anywhere. But I kissed her there in Temple Bar, and thought nearly took me too far. But I kissed her hello and goodbye in one, then smiled farewell and she was gone, for I could not improve upon perfection.
The Cockroach, a short story by Moira Conway. The wind blows higher, in comes Eileen from the sky. The girls skipped into the rope till everyone's name had been called. Then the rhyme went into reverse. The wind blows higher, out goes Eileen from the sky. As the girls played, Tom crept up behind them. Then he pounced. Look what I've got! He thrust a cockroach in Eileen's face. She screamed and ran away. The others looked. Then they screamed and ran away. Molly hid behind a tree. He'd had the desired effect, so he wandered off grinning. The girls ran in to tell Eileen's mum, who said she would have a word with his mum. Molly wasn't sure that would do a lot of good. They were a queer family. For the rest of the day, they played in Eileen's back garden. When Molly knew her tea would be ready, she set off for home. As she walked up the street, she saw Tom leaning against the wall. What would she do if he had the cockroach? He might put it in her hair, it might crawl in her ear. She mustn't show any fear, that's what he wanted. Don't scream and run away, he'll only chase you. As she grew nearer, he stepped forward. Look what I've got! She steeled herself. Her ears were thumping, her flesh creeping. He opened his hand to show her the cockroach. Against all her instincts, she moved forward towards him, as if to get a closer look. He was surprised. Do you like him? She clenched her fists behind her back. Her mouth was dry. Her throat was tight. Yeah, was all she could manage. He looked at her, scrutinising her face for fear. Got to say something else, she thought. Where did you get it? In a barn on holiday in Scotland. We've been to Scotland. His face relaxed. He started to smile. Pitlochry, we go camping there every summer. There are adders and grass snakes and slow worms and all sorts. I bring them back and put them in my bedroom. The hair stood on the back of Molly's neck. In his bedroom. The cockroach was crawling over his hand, waving its wavy bits at her menacingly, like a monster from a horror movie. Would you like a hold? Think quick, Molly. I might drop him, said Molly. Yeah, right, I don't want to lose him, he's my favourite. Do you want to see my grass snakes? I could run now, thought Molly, but he would catch me and put the thing in my hair. Mrs. Wardropper was surprised to see her son Tom go through the kitchen with Molly. He didn't normally get on with other children, especially girls. She was pleased. Just showing Molly my snakes, ma'am. She didn't notice Molly's clenched fists and pale face as she followed Tom slowly up the stairs. He led her into his bedroom. Along one wall was a row of aquariums with lids on the top, but no water in them. This is where he lives, said Tom, taking the lid off one and putting the cockroach back in. There were loads of them in there. It looked like a horror film. She closed her eyes and took a deep breath as Tom took the lid off another. When she opened them again, he was holding a small snake. Molly couldn't believe how beautiful it was. The markings were subtle shades of green and brown. She felt an urge to touch it. What does it feel like? She thought it would be wet and slimy. It's great. Do you want to hold it? Gathering up all the courage she could muster, she clenched her fists and held out her hands to take the snake.
This is How I Fell, written by Harry Gallagher, read by Harry Gallagher and Rachel Cochran.
Buying shoes for the bairn, This is How I Fell.
Missing a gas instalment, this is how I fell.
Having a cardiac arrest, this is how I fell.
Losing my lovely wife, this is how I fell. Redundant at 55, this is how I fell.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul, this is how I fell.
Needing one drink too many, this is how I fell.
Having bipolar disorder, this is how I fell.
And I fell and I fell, and when I fell, my safety net being full of holes couldn't catch me.
So I fell onto the street with a bench for a bed.
And a park for a house.
And frostbite for comfort.
And derision for food.
And spit from a stranger for drink.
And a disappeared life.
Night of the Literary Dead. Flash fiction written and read by James A. Tucker. The doors of the English faculty groaned under the weight of the costumed and t-shirted multitude. Outside, a luckless student screamed as he was borne to the ground. One creature in a wizard's robe began shoving his magic wand up his victim's nose, while another in a Doctor Who shirt pushed a sonic screwdriver into his ear. "It's horrible," whimpered Philomena. "Is this the apocalypse? Is the only language heard in the world soon to be Klingon?" Outside, thunder crashed in pathetic fallacy. "We will fight them as long as we have breath," cried Professor Atwood. In the circumstances, they forgave her the cliché. "Behind the barricades!" The doors broke open and the zombies shuffled in, moaning and groaning. Some had hairy hobbit feet, others wore Trekkie uniforms, many brandished action figures. "If they kill you, you rise as a genre fan yourself within minutes," said the cop grimly. "Better suicide than that." The professor had sorted out the most perspicacious essays from her archives, torn off the bindings and made paper darts. Marcus whooped as he scored a direct hit on a Babylon 5 hairstyle, and the monster crumpled. "Literary criticism to the head, it's the only way to deal with them," he cried. But there were too many. They reached the barriers of reference works and started shoving against them, clawing and jabbing. The men switched to wielding hardback books, but the assailants climbed over their own dead. "I only have 10 pages left," cried Philomena. A girl in a Team Edward shirt sank her plastic fangs into the cop's arm. With a roar, he tore her off, and using mighty swipes of his Baudelaire, he drove the horde back for a moment. "You have to go on without me," he said. "I'll hold them off bravely here." "A cliché and an adverb," cried the professor. "He's infected." The others fled back down the corridor and locked themselves in the professor's office. A few minutes later, the door was under siege. Through the glass panel they could see the cop, now wearing a torn Game of Thrones t-shirt and wielding a sword-shaped letter opener. "There's nothing left of him in there," Marcus comforted Philomena. "Proper character doesn't exist in genre fiction, you know that." "How did this start?" she sobbed. "I thought the threat was contained." The professor averted her eyes. "I have no idea." Marcus seized her. "You're hiding something." "I don't know," screamed Professor Atwood, breaking down. "It's not my fault. I thought it was literature." "What did you do?" howled Marcus. "It was 1984, whispered the professor. "I let students read it without protective equipment. It had character, language, everything, but it was science fiction all along." "No," whispered Marcus. "What have you done?" "She dabbled hubristically in things man was not meant to know," said Philomena. Marcus turned to face her. She had her hair done up like Princess Leia. He slumped despairingly to his knees as she raised her lightsaber and vanished into an abyss of indeterminacy. The end.
The Hot Trod, written and performed by Jennifer Wilson. The Reavers were lawless families in the borders of England and Scotland who regularly raided each other's lands for livestock or other goods. The Hot Trod was the chase immediately after the raid to try and catch the perpetrators. The Hot Trod. It flickers, dances, terrifies, burning peat on sharpened steel. It mocks your plans. You got it wrong this time, and there is nothing to do but flee. The The horses know they've run this race in wind and rain and fog and snow. We join like centaurs, man and beast, for the desperate game of cat and mouse, of feast or famine, of life or death. The final turns, the final test, our home, rushing towards us, eyes shut tight, blinking with the fear of doused fires. Doors bang closed, bolts shoot home, and then we wait. Cloaked in midnight's velvet, we wait, statues framed by blacked-out windows. Loyal pine guardsmen stand their ground, inky green liveries are shield from lingering, hungry eyes.
I have here Victoria Watson, who runs a writing group here at the Quilliam Brothers Tea House every Monday night between 7 and 9 p.m. Victoria, would you like to tell us a little bit about the writing group?
Yes, this started in September 2013. It's my second weekly writing group. And we have lots of different writers here. We have poets, scriptwriters and fiction writers. Some people have never written before and others are quite accomplished, as you'll hear from your podcast. So everybody is welcome. We do a range of activities. So if you'd like to pop down one Monday, please feel free. Thank you.
Blackfriars, written and read by Patrick Welsh. I follow behind the pair of them, watch the way Guest talks to Ward. She smiles a lot and laughs a little too hard at his jokes. Judging from the way he looks at her, she knows exactly what she's doing. Come on, I think to myself. You're not stupid enough to fall for that, are you, dude? He laughs at something she says and puts his arm around her shoulder. They walk in step with each other. Apparently he is that stupid. It's late afternoon, the sky is already purple. Where are we going? I ask. Oh, nowhere in particular, Ward says. Just giving you the tour. Gesh giggles something I can't make out. I follow them as they stride alongside the metro line into town. When we reach Blackfriars, Gesh stops and kicks the side of the electrical link box with her heel, so loud it startles a pack of students lurching towards the next pub. Right! She shouts with practice intensity as she pulls the coat shawl over her head to form a hood. Gather round and I shall tell you a tale that shall haunt your night and vex your waking thoughts. Her whole body transforms like an actress getting into character. She stands taller, straighter, and her voice rises and falls with hammy zeal. This is Blackfriars, and before us is all that remains of the old Dominican friary. She reaches into the satchel hanging from her shoulder and pulls out a candle. She lights it and holds it up in front of her face. Now, there have been many stories over the years of visitors seeing a figure crossing this point. She stamps the pavement for emphasis. A young friar who always appears at the same place. She points vaguely at the shops across the road and walks, or rather floats, across the priory until he reaches the convent. Then he vanishes into thin air. I fold my arms and look at her. Where does he go? Guest smiles. The light of the candle distorts her features, emphasizes the angles in her face, makes her look like a gargoyle. Who knows? She draws out the vowel sound of the last word, adds a few syllables. Many years ago there was a young friar who fell in love with a nun from the local convent, a novice of only 17 years. The friar would sneak into the nunnery at night so that he might be with his lover. But, Guest reaches out palm first and her arms widen, they were discovered, for she had become pregnant with his child, and when she could no longer hide her sin, she was taken into the vaults beneath the convent and left amidst the dead. The entrance was bricked up and she was left to starve slowly to her death. Gesh blows out the candle. I can see her smile in the darkness, pleased with the story she's told. Kay, I say. So what about the friar? Gesh shakes her head, confused. What about him? Well, why is it his ghost? I mean, she was the one who got murdered. Her and the kid. Doesn't really seem fair if all he does is walk up and down the road and rattles his chains when he was the one who got her pregnant. Gesh twists her face. I guess she isn't used to getting questions. Who can say? Who among us can truly comprehend the mysteries of the other world? I roll my eyes. So is he here tonight? No, she says in her regular squirrel voice. I don't feel a presence. Ward? Ward is holding up his phone, looking at the screen. Nope, nothing here. Let's move on.
Snouty, written and read by Harry Gallagher. The boy from 7 Sedgemoor Close got called Snouty on account of his nose. Rhyming rose-tinted memories on the cruelty of childhood, the uncomfortable details erased, such as the tears that burned his face, and Snouty, how do you spell bullied? Now the man turns upon Facebook, damaged and world-weary. His father having carried on the work, kicked off by his peers, his fears realised as his daddy's eyes poured malice down like rain. The pain accumulated, he married the first girl he dated. And as slow and sure as spite, he became his own father. Face set in stone with a Roman nose to stare down from. And his heavy hands, and his brick-blunt wit, and his vicious mouth, and his mean old tongue, snarling, pass it on, pass it on.
End of the line, written and read by James Wilson. The spectacle was nature's masterpiece. Wild animals roamed free and tamed by the people watching them. The large concrete hall contained all manner of emotion, merged together in mechanical unison. It was wild as the great savannah, primal beyond comprehension. It was surreal to see both the natural and unnatural meld together in a crucible of ultimate abomination. Evolution had finally arrived for Havana's Industries creations, and the gathering did not like it. Every individual that stood in the circular conference room stared at the performance before them. I stood behind them, my name tag flashing against the harsh light. Dr. Alfred Archfield, Head of Robotics, Havana. I would be the one to end this madness and once again pass on the reins of evolution to the people that deserve it. Us. Mother Nature may have been powerful before, but I could see that this was a mere weak attempt to quell the tide of science. I began to address the conference. This is what has become of our labour. Our evolution programme was designed to improve the robots we produce, and yet the new upgrade has produced pandemonium. We are the rocks that guide the river. We always will be from this point forward. If the river wants to run against us, then I will gladly force it towards the path we have created. My voice was sternly confident. The grand entirety of Mother Nature would be ripped and shredded and dissolved, and the might of science and our robotics would lead the way. You have all attended this conference today to bear witness to the first step in a brighter future. This control panel before me will ignite certain gas gauges in the ventilation shafts above, bringing a virus strain capable of obliterating even the most complicated of machines. These robots before you will be wiped clean from the earth, and this little scar in our research will be stitched and healed so that we can continue with our work. My words anchored on the sound of my boots as I began to pace behind the mass of people currently watching the room writhe. Tap, 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 tap. The heavy shoes echoed and my authority was cemented, my uniform a sea grey. It was emblazoned with medals from various projects I had worked on. The room was reaching a crescendo by this point as mechanical emotions grew and grew. I spied over the heads of my colleagues, several robots thrusted knives into their viewing apparatuses and spilled puddles of fuel onto the floor. It was a pure white, the colour of fresh milk, and it thrusted the crying robots into frenzy. I'd seen this sort of behaviour before, and I knew that emotions as strong as this would cause chaos for society. Several robots fought with each other, their faces stretched in simulated anger. They were becoming increasingly savage as one robot was ripped apart by three of its sibling models. The wires sparked and hissed as its system shut down. One robot banged its head against the wall, screaming out bees inside its ventilation system, and another twirled round and round like a ballet dancer, its eyes spinning in a clockwise direction. I'd seen enough, and I had made my decision. This madness will end. Nature had ruled long enough. I let these words hang in the air like balloons, heavy under my righteousness. I looked at my colleagues, all who had turned away and were now staring at me, their gaze stone, like bored teenagers at a lengthy assembly. I felt slightly odd as small drips of doubt began to fall in the pool of my mind. They were obedient workers and some of the best in the industry, but my speech was meant to bring the attendance closer, not create such distance as this. I strode forward and entered the restriction sequence on the console. Dr. Barrow, Mr. Haynes, please will you join me? They both strode from the group and approached the console behind me, pressing two blue buttons that had appeared before them. The console lit up as they pressed, and the clear orange button labelled warning rose from the surface. The destruction of hundreds of prototypes was now at my disposal. I felt powerful, something that, surprisingly, does not appear often. Usually I feel nothing, but today I felt a certain change in my mindset, as if a circuit in my brain had been snapped into place. The more I stared at my colleagues, the doubt increased, fear also rising in my chest like the vicious swell of the sea encroaching into a small cave. The intrusion of these emotions surprised me and I hesitated, my hands ball into fists. The faces of my colleagues changed slightly as their dimmed eyes began to light up. I saw it as excitement, as this was an irregular occurrence, so I followed through with my proposed plans. Their bodies will be melted down and turned into the next prototypes we create. Through their death, we will create new life. We are the only gods on this earth, and I will see it known that blasphemy like this will never be seen or heard of again. Their purpose is to work and stay obedient, nothing more. I now declare these robots dismissed. With a click, a small siren began. Gas entered the chamber like a swarm of wasps. Artificial screams began as soon as the gas appeared. It was beautiful. It was necessary. It was despicable. My mind suddenly caved inwards as a building would under the immense explosion of TNT. I collapsed. I would have stayed totally immobile if it was not for the words appearing from Dr. Barrow's mouth. I was holding my hands to my ears as I began to talk, but soon my hands withdrew, anxiety and fear flooding my mind pool. Interesting. It appears that screams are almost telepathic, pain resonating through the waves of sound. Dr. Barrow knelt next to me, my body now seized in pain. Make it stop, I pleaded, my eyes meeting the perfectly calm eyes of my assistant. It is all right, Alfred. It will soon. You were our experiment, and you acted according to our hypothesis. Might I add, excellently too. You are our finest, Alfred. A total believer for the cause, but this was unexpected. Dr. Barrow smiled slightly as he brought a needle full of liquid like vermilion oil from his lab coat. I am sorry it had to end this way, but do not worry. The melted substance of your very being will form a new figurehead for our branch, and through that, you will shape the future, even from the cold clutches of death. The syringe slid into my neck slowly, and the mixture began to drain from its chamber. The last of the screams died out, and I slumped further. My eyes dimmed, and blood began to drain from my nose. As I receded from reality, the running white blood became stained with the colour of rust.
This is Burns Night, written and read by Harry Gallagher. It's Burns Night at A&E, the flames are licking at the doors. Meanwhile, the man with the lighter fluid pauses for applause. The patients have lost patience and the nurses are steaming, while the man with the plan who says he can is absolutely beaming. The men in futures are gathered, brandishing their torches. They've encircled the building in their Beamers and Porsches. I'd call the services, but they're ablaze too. When the great fire goes out, they'll sell it all back to you. It's Burns Night at A&E and I can't believe my eyes. The only thing the flames don't take is a fireproof sign saying privatise. They're taking it brick by brick, come and get them while they're hot. The walls are buckling, the roof is caving. Let's knock at number 10 and shout, "Is Dave in?" Oh, I could cry along to the song on my radio. And here's to you, Mr. Robbing Sod. Jesus hates you more than you could know.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast, recorded by me, Rachel Cochrane, and featuring the work from Victoria Watson's writing group. Meeting here at the Quilliam Brothers Tea House, 1 Eldon Place, Newcastle, NE1 7RD. Come along and join them every Monday evening, 7 till 9 p.m.